I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. If I had to guess what officials at MoDOT are thinking 3 weeks after voters batted down a proposed gas tax increase, it would be, what's next? Today, we'll speak with the director of the Missouri Department of Transportation. He'll tell us what the future looks like for Missouri's roads and bridges, and I'll ask him about the snow, of course. Then plenty of folks wonder how they'll be remembered after their death. What's one way to ensure it's a good recollection? By writing your own obituary, of course. We'll find out why the practice is catching on and get some advice for doing it in a tasteful way. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. For the Missouri Department of Transportation, the question now is, what's next? What's next for state highways now that voters have rejected an increase in the gasoline tax? Ideas are starting to emerge, and here to talk about the road ahead is Patrick McKenna. He's the director of the Missouri Department of Transportation. Patrick, thanks for taking some time. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Glad to be here.
Before we talk about funding state road needs, we just talked about the Kansas roads, the condition after the storm this weekend. What are you seeing on the Missouri side today as you look across the state, Patrick?
Well, very similar, Steve. We've had crews out all weekend, and our emergency operations centers in the affected areas are still activated. So we've got crews out there. We've had multiple shifts. And as the trooper mentioned, in Kansas, we've had a lot of varying conditions, a lot of very difficult driving conditions with low visibility and essentially packing of snow onto the roadways. So as those conditions continued throughout the state, we've been monitoring those. We've had crews out. The sun is our friend as that's opening up today. It's enabling our crews to get the blades down and get some of that packed snow off of the roadways. So we're going to be cleaning up for a number of hours throughout the day into the evening tonight and try to make it so that it's so we've got it all cleaned up and buttoned up before it refreezes tonight.
You know, was the entire state hit here?
Well, you know, we had five of our seven districts activated in terms of emergency operations. Our Southwest and Southeast were not as impacted. However, what we did was we utilized resources from those areas and we shifted them up. So we had people traveling from the southwestern part of Missouri up through Kansas City into the St. Joe area to help out with crews up there. Wow. Because that's where the need was. So we pre-positioned and had those resources moving. We had to move some, you know, this is pretty early in the season for us. We did have to move some materials around. Some salt had to be moved. And so we had a lot of activity going on ahead of the storm and then throughout the evening last night.
You know, how big a challenge is it, you know, when the state is hit like it was yesterday, Patrick, and when it comes to cleaning off the roads? Because this was a fairly rare occurrence, at least for in the Kansas City area, and I'm sure for much of central Missouri as well.
Well, we are, you know, as a department, we're smaller than we used to be. A decade ago, we had about 1,200 more people. We had 124 more maintenance facilities. So we're a leaner department, and we do a very good job, I think, of sharing resources among and between districts. Our maintenance districts and our logistics folks work really hard at that, being efficient. But when we do get hit with something that extends throughout the state, it's a very significant challenge for us. And the other challenge is in a very tight labor market, we are having and experiencing a lot of turnover. So as we started pre-planning for our winter maintenance operations back in June and July, we could see we were down about 900 heavy equipment operators and folks throughout the department statewide, mostly in Kansas City and St. Louis, our major metropolitan areas. So that's been a very significant challenge for our operations folks. Our division leadership in Kansas City has done a really nice job of standing up a maintenance academy so that with new people coming on board at a rate of about 200 a year, we're trying to bring them up to speed very quickly and get them the skills and knowledge they need to be effective in the snow fights.
Yeah, I'm just curious, did you salt the roads last night? Were you sanding them? What were you using out there?
Well, it was a combination of things. You know, we try to manage our chlorides, you know, trying to be environmentally sensitive. But we also know that certain conditions just require it. So we did have salting operations out there. In the areas where we were getting a mix of rain and then a freeze over, but not getting very, very cold, at least in the early hours, we did use a brine. You know, so we have a brine, which is essentially a water mix with chlorides and or, say, beet juice. And that enables us to treat in advance of icing. And that
did you say beet juice, Patrick?
Yeah, we do. We do have some techniques that are taking advantage of local products, and you know the sugar that's in the beet actually is a binding agent, so it binds the chlorides that we do use in that mixture to the road surface. So we're not inefficient with that use of the chloride itself.
Now, who discovered beet juice as a way to treat roads in icy conditions?
You know, all over the country, there are different techniques used in creating this. I can't point exactly to the creator of it, but I have a feeling it was somebody that grows beets.
That would be a good guess, wouldn't it? That makes
right,
a lot of sense.
Right.
Patrick McKenna is my guest. He's director of the Missouri Department of Transportation. Well, let's turn to the challenges of facing the future of the road system in Missouri following this month's defeat of Prop D. You've had a few weeks to look at it, Patrick. What happened and why did that proposition, why did voters reject it so soundly?
Well, you know, it's interesting as we've looked at it, because if you compare it to a statewide initiative back in 2014, Amendment 7, which was not a gas tax increase, but it was a sales tax increase, we actually had about 700,000 Missourians more in support. So about 1.1 million Missourians did agree that an increased investment for transportation purposes was necessary. I think if you went back 18 months, if anybody thought that we were going to collect 1.1 million yes votes, I think people would have been thinking that would have been a favorable result.
Right.
What I think did happen was the national political landscape, the election functioned a lot like a presidential election rather than a midterm. So I think we had a very large turnout. We had folks that just are concerned about their general level of taxation in general, and there's always a fairly significant part of the population that really does not want to see any increases come in any form of government taxation. It's unfortunate, because in the case of transportation, where we're funded primarily through user fees, the more you use, the more you pay, the less you use, the less you pay. That's a very difficult proposition, but it is a challenging policy issue, not only here in Missouri, but across the country. We have had similar challenges at the federal level since 1993 as well.
You know, there was some thought that the ballot language here was confusing because, as you know, it focused on funding the highway patrol instead of fixing up roads. Do you think that was a factor?
Well, we are hearing that created a little bit of confusion.
Sure.
I think I do have to say, you know, when I looked at the policymaker discussions in the last session, I thought there were some really thoughtful deliberations and debates going on. Granted, it required a little bit of knowledge of the way the state constitution worked and a realization that both the Missouri State Highway Patrol, who are our partners out there, none more evident than over the course of the last this past couple days. We work together in terms of public safety out there in the state roadways, and we're funded from the same source of funds. So when you realize that the Missouri State Highway Patrol is limited in what they can draw from the state road funds by virtue of what their actual cost of enforcing motor vehicle laws are, and you realize that funding comes from the same source, you know, designating funding to support public safety also made available funding for public works. It was a little confusing, and that I think had some degree of impact, but I don't think it was really the primary impact. It's one of those things that if you're concerned about government funding in general, I think you could point to that and say, that's a little confusing, and that's going to be a threshold for me not to breach. But I think that's probably a lot of the same folks that would have voted down a straight gas tax increase, no matter how it was written.
So your theory is that it was simply one more tax and people are thinking they're taxed enough. Is that sort of the working theory in terms of the primary motivator for people turning this thing down?
I believe so.
Yeah. And there was also some talk that the proposed increase was too modest and maybe you should have gone for even a bigger boost than a dime over a number of years. What do you say to that?
Well, I think it's interesting. If we point back, and one of the things I would point to is the work of the Missouri General Assembly by putting out a year ago the 21st Century Task Force. It was a piece of legislation that appointed the task force. It was bipartisan, bicameral, and had public and private individuals that were on it. Traveled around the state, wrote what I thought is a very thoughtful report. It looked at the conditions of the system. It looked at why we're here, and it made some recommendations about how to move forward. And one of those recommendations was an immediate impact investment. Now, you have to get to the underlying factors. Why do we have a system that's somewhat underfunded? And, as we've pointed out through MoDOT, we've looked at the system, we've looked at the needs, and we've calculated through our citizens guide an estimate of what the unfunded needs are. And those unfunded needs are well over $800 million a year. Now, consider we have a capital program that uses state and federal funds that equals about $900 million a year. So we're funded only about half of the capital construction work that we believe needs to be done and is expressed by Missourians what the unfunded needs are in our surveys and long-range planning process. But that has developed over time. And one of the difficult things to get across is it builds gradually each year with the loss to inflation or purchasing power each year. Mm-hmm. The revenue sources for transportation don't grow with the general economy the way income and sales taxes do. Mm-hmm. User fees for transportation, the gas tax, is a set amount per gallon consumed. And that doesn't grow with the general economy, so we lose purchasing power. And in construction, for highway construction, that's averaged about 3% a year over the last couple decades. Some years a little bit higher, some years a little bit lower. But in general, that 3% a year. Mm-hmm. So over 22 years, in any given year, that's not a big deal. We lose about $27 to $30 million of purchasing power a year on our current construction. But then what we're not getting to also has a increased cost next year if we don't get to it this year. That kind of slow and gradual build is not a policy crisis in any given year, but stack it up over two decades and it becomes a big problem. Now, if you couple that with another development, which is rising fuel economy of the average vehicle, it's not just electric vehicle conversion. It's when you go out and replace today a 10-year-old pickup truck, you might go from 16 or 17 miles per gallon to 28 or 30.
Right.
That is a very significant drop in revenue per mile driven. And those two factors combined are creating a very significant issue, not only here in Missouri, but across the country, in terms of unfunded needs. Now, the scale of what we need to do by having multiple decades of kind of not addressing that problem, if you're to take and try to solve the entire problem right now through user fees, think about that. We'd be saying something that took 30 years to develop, we're going to ask current users to take care of in, say, the next 10 years.
Right.
That's public policy that's difficult. So to put it in simple terms, to fix the entire problem, the gas tax increase would have had to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 35 cents per gallon. Now, 10 cents didn't pass. Can you imagine how we would have done on a 35 cent?
Yeah.
And really, when you think about it, we'd be asking people to take care of multiple decades all at once.
Right.
That's probably not good policy.
Patrick McKenna is my guest. He heads the Missouri Department of Transportation, otherwise known as MoDOT. To get our listeners involved here, why do you think the gas tax failed earlier this month? Why do you think Missourians are so reluctant to approve higher taxes to pay for roads? Our number, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. So I guess, Patrick, the big question on the table now is, now what? I mean, what kinds of conversations are you having with lawmakers? What's the road ahead?
Well, you know, it's interesting because when I point to the 21st Century Transportation Task Force report, and that's out on the General Assembly's website, or if you just Google it and say 21st Century Transportation Task Force, it'll bring the report up for you. It actually created a roadmap. It had a multi-step process where several ideas were fleshed out. The first was really to create an immediate impact investment to catch up to inflation. But the additional ideas in the report, I think, are valid for consideration in public policy. There are several that deal with our license and registration fees and the fact that those have also not kept pace with inflation. There are notations in there about the rising fuel economy of the vehicle fleet and addressing on a parity basis to make sure that people are effectively paying about the same rate, whether you're using a highly efficient vehicle or one that's less efficient. You should probably be paying about the same amount for the access and use of the transportation network. So there are some ideas in this report. One of them has to do with looking at converting the registration fee, which is based on taxable horsepower, into something like a mileage-based fee.
I think Missouri is the only state in the country that still uses the horsepower standard, right?
I believe you're right.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. So that's one more idea on the table, right?
It is. And I what I gather from policymakers and what I gather from, you know, imagine I am really amazed and really thankful that Governor Parson has come in and taken this mantle on as infrastructure and workforce development being two primary ways that we can move Missouri forward for Missourians in terms of economic development going forward. And having both Governor Parson and Lieutenant Governor Kehoe, who actually formerly served as the Missouri Highway and Transportation Commission chair
right
before he got into politics, before he held elected office, having the two top state leaders really understand this issue and know that this is a critical issue for the safety and well-being of Missourians, that's a hugely important leadership position that we're in as a state. So I do believe, and I have heard with the legislature coming in, that this is one of the issues that they intend to continue to discuss and debate, try to find those solutions. So I'm hopeful in that regard.
How is Missouri going to finance its road system going forward in the wake of the defeat of Prop D earlier on this month? Our number, 816-235-2888. Our guest is Patrick McKenna. He's director of the Missouri Department of Transportation. Steve from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Quick question. I, like myself, do quite a bit of driving around the Kansas City area, and a lot of the streets in Kansas City, obviously in Missouri, are in miserable shape. Can you tell us where the money comes from to repair and or keep up roads in Kansas City?
Patrick, how about a local question there? How do Kansas City's road crews repair streets here in our town?
Well, it's a combination. Again, this is multiple levels and layers of government combine forces to work on the entire transportation network. At the state level, we manage 10,400 bridges and about 34,000 miles of road. But at the local level, there's another 97,000 miles of road. So local governments, your Kansas City, Missouri state local government actually has taxes at the local level that build their public works department budget. So a combination of things, including income and sales tax at the local level, contribute to the budget allocation of resources for local street work, as well as people, I think, don't realize, but when you pay gas tax at the state level, there's an allocation of those resources that goes directly to Kansas City. It goes to each county and each municipality. So we have currently a 17-cent gas tax in Missouri, and approximately 3 cents of that goes to cities, and 3 cents of that goes to counties. Hmm. So your county government and your city government get a share of what you pay in gas tax, and that's a pretty significant amount of money. That has not increased since 1996. So the local budgets are as problematic from a transportation investment perspective as it is at the state level.
Okay. Let's go back to some calls. And John from Kansas City, Missouri, who can tell us why he voted against the gas tax increase. John, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to mention that the reason I voted against the tax is because there was such a large discrepancy between the dollar amount allocated to the Highway Patrol versus what was going to the road fund. And my question then is, why was there such a large discrepancy given the sources and equipment that Highway Patrol obviously has versus the problem that the language of the tax was trying to solve, which is the road problem?
Having a little trouble understanding you, John, but he's asking about the discrepancy in the allocation of funds between the Highway Patrol allotment and the money that was going to repair roads, Patrick.
Yeah, and this is a little bit, Steve, of what we talked about.
Yes.
With the confusion before. The way that the funding worked, what was designated for local roads is what I just talked about. So that out of the 10 cents, there would have been essentially 3 cents of that would have gone directly to the communities. And in the ballot language, it said that, you know, 100 and – whoop, did we get cut off?
No,
there?
You're here. You're fine.
Sorry. So it showed that $123 million was going to go to local governments. And I think people misinterpreted that as understanding that to be the only investment in roads and bridges. That was the local share of the 10 cents. 3 cents of that was going to go to localities. The $288 million that was designated for the Missouri State Highway Patrol, that effectively would have just, on a budget basis, displaced their current funding, and it would have made effectively that entire amount available for road and bridge investment. So actually, all $400 million would have been able to be invested about 70% of it on the state system and 30% of it on the local system. And because the Highway Patrol and MoDOT get funded out of the state road fund, it was really just adding about another 300 and available. It was going to be designated legislatively for the Highway Patrol, but they cannot charge the road fund more than their actual costs of enforcement. So it was a little confusing. I gather from that call, from John's
right.
call, that that was a troubling part of the language.
Are you close at MoDOT to closing roads and bridges?
Well, you know, what we do is we go through a capital plan development process. It really happens all year long. It's a 5-year plan. It gets updated each year. So we go through the Missouri Highway and Transportation Commission. We work with local leaders like MARC, our Metropolitan Planning Organization, and local regional planning commissions. And we allocate funds based on what's available, both at the state and the federal level. And then we work with the local leaders to determine the highest level priorities. So what we really do try to do is stay ahead of the curve. We're really trying to stay ahead of the bridge condition. That is one of the big and troubling factors going forward, is that we have so many bridges at the state level, you know, 10,000 that we manage at the state level, and about 20% of them are in need of repair right now. But then there's also the local bridges. There's an additional 14,000 bridges in the state that local governments maintain, and there's another 2,000 of those bridges that need repair pretty quickly.
But we shouldn't be surprised if we start seeing bridges being closed then, because they're in such lousy shape?
Well, what we try to do is we try to put the money, we try to target it to the places that most need it even within a within an allocation of resources. So we're really struggling. We're trying to keep them open. We're inspecting them more frequently because of the age and condition. But there are some projects. I don't think it should be a surprise. There are projects that we need to take care of that are not going to be as large or significant as would have been had the gas tax passed. We just have to allocate the resources that we have. And we have to prioritize those, and there will be some hard decisions going forward. We also have work to do at the federal level. There's federal funding runs out at the end of 2020, and Congress needs to act to reauthorize federal funding for surface transportation.
Right.
So we're working at the national level to do that. One of our bigger problems, should there be a movement at the federal level to solve this, Missouri could be in a position where we might not be able to access all of the federal funds if we don't have enough resources to match them.
That was my next question. Are we going to lose out on federal funds going forward? Is that a certainty or is it still up in the air?
Well, at present, we are matching all of our current federal funds. We're spending a little bit more money every year than we're bringing in order to do so. But because we have that's such an important thing to do, we get for every dollar we spend on the state road system, we can draw in almost $4 on the federal system within the limitations of the federal program. Okay. So we can only deficit spend for probably another couple years in order to do so. And then if there's an increase at the federal level, we might be challenged to be able to match those. And that's really one of the things that the legislature is trying to get a handle on as we're having discussions with them. When does that hit and how do we react to that?
One more call here. Let's go to Rudolph from Raytown. Rudolph, you're on with Patrick McKenna. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Director McKenna. I thank you very much for coming on and explaining the position. I was a supporter of the gas tax. I had encouraged many of my friends to support the gas tax. However, now that the gas tax is not being supported, I don't want to hear from the other voters about how bad Missouri roads are, because we've had two opportunities in 2002 and again in 2018 to provide money to fix those, and both times the voters turned those down. So, Director McKenna, I thank you for stepping up to the plate and answering questions from Steve Kratzky, one of our best journalists in the Kansas City area. And I'll take any comments off the air.
Yeah, Rudolph, thank you for the call. And I gather you probably don't disagree a whole lot with Rudolph, Patrick.
Well, you know, I appreciate, you know, having that citizen engagement and being willing to step forward and understand that, you know, it's a shared responsibility. This is truly citizen government when it comes to a referendum to address a critical need. And the road system, the bridge network, the transportation system, every one of us rely on this every single day. So keeping it in good repair, never mind expanding it to be beneficial to the state in terms of what our needs are for the next century, it's critically important. So having folks that do understand that and express that is really, I do appreciate the comments. And it's a challenge that we all share together.
That's Patrick McKenna. He's director of the Missouri Department of Transportation. Patrick, thanks for taking some time and happy holidays to you.
Thank you, Steve. Same to you.
Thanks so much. Time for a break. When we come back, maybe it's time for you to write your own obituary. We'll talk about it. I'm Steve Kratzky, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kratzky. Last week on the show, we talked with former and future Missouri Education Commissioner Margie Van Deven about getting her old job back after being let go. You can hear that and other previous episodes. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, an insider view of what it's like being a new lawmaker. We'll meet a couple newly elected policymakers in Missouri and Kansas and learn about the transition to the statehouse. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date.
estate. Well, the new trend in obituaries, how about writing your own obituary yourself? That's right, they're called self-obits, and it ranks as the most effective way to ensure that you are remembered the way you want to be remembered. If the idea smacks of hubris, or if thinking about your own death seems too uncomfortable, well, maybe it's time to think again. Annie Presley is the co-author of Read This When I'm Dead, a guide to getting your stuff together for your loved ones to help you on your way. She's best known for her work as a fundraiser for both nonprofits as well as politicians, but now she's launched a new late career. And Annie, welcome back. So good to have you here.
Thank you, Steve. I'm glad to be here.
Tell me about this new trend of people writing their own obituaries. When did this get going?
So what's happening is, entrepreneurs like to say, there's a lot of disruption going on in the death industry. The funeral business in particular. And yes. Christy and I have gone all over the country introducing our book around, and we've heard this over and over. And one of the ways to tackle your own funeral is to write your own obituary so that you'll be remembered the way you want to be rather than how you were remembered by a bunch of friends and family members trying to get it written in the fog of your death.
I was going to say, how did it used to get done? Because I remember writing my mom's obituary, and I guess I must have been so upset that I got all kinds of facts wrong in the obituary. And in theory, I'm a professional journalist, and I still screwed it up, you know?
It's just because you are in the fog at that time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there are so many details you can't remember and you can't think of. So the whole idea now is to go ahead and just take the bull by the horns and write it yourself.
You know, and newspapers don't have obituary writers like they used to have, right?
The New York Times is really the last one, and I'm sure some rural country papers do that as well. But the New York Times still have obituary writers. In fact, there's a great documentary about that.
Yeah, and the obits in the New York Times are always just terrific, too.
Well, and you have to
be famous.
Such
interesting people. Yeah, you got to be famous to get there.
Sure.
Now, this is a hard idea for some people to wrap their arms around, this idea of writing their own obituary. You know, one reason is people don't want to accept the fact that they may not be around forever. What do you say to them?
Well, this is changing. We're seeing a cultural shift on this as well. We've been really bad about talking about end of life, and it's starting to change. In fact, what we're seeing is the funeral industry, so to speak, is starting to be more like a wedding celebration, and funerals are turning into parties. So it's a $17 billion industry right now, while wedding planning is over $50 billion. But we're seeing funeral planning go up. And so there's a lot of activity. Aretha Franklin's recent funeral was a three-hour concert.
That's right.
A going-home celebration. So we're seeing a lot of that now.
Oh, what about the notion that writing your own obituary sort of smacks of hubris? Your last act on earth is you're bragging about what you did.
Well, interestingly, there's a darling movie that came out last year starring Shirley MacLaine. And
we have a little clip from that, yeah.
It's adorable. So she wants to be remembered the way she thinks she should be, and there is no substitution for liars and cheaters, as it turns out.
Well, let's play a clip from the film that Annie just mentioned. It's titled The Last Word, that deals with this idea of getting your obituary written while you're still alive. This is Shirley MacLaine, who plays a once successful businesswoman, speaking with Amanda Seyfried, playing a local writer.
You want me to write your obituary?
That's what I want.
Okay. Well, I am the obituary writer. So when the time comes, I will be writing your obituary.
I want you to write it now.
Huh. Is Ron coming back?
That's the wrong question. The right question is why.
Why?
Good question.
Thanks.
Miss Sherman, I'm a reasonable woman. I have never been surprised about anything, and I've never found myself in a situation that I couldn't handle. So, as a reasonable woman, the thought of leaving my obituary to chance is completely unreasonable to me.
But that is what everybody does. That is what people have been doing for hundreds of years.
If I had motivated myself by what other people thought and did, I would not have achieved what I've achieved, and I've achieved a great deal. How my achievements are memorialized by you is of great interest to me.
That's really true. By letting someone else do it, you are sort of leaving it for chance.
Totally. I was at a funeral recently, and they'd forgotten a whole bunch of cousins in the obituary, and they were screaming mad about it. Very disappointed. So you just can't expect to have that kind of comprehension that you need when you're in the fog.
Have you written your own?
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fun. I'm happy. I'm having a big celebration. I'm having my cremains packed into fireworks. Absolutely.
Is that right?
You bet.
And shot off outside the
funeral
home? Yeah,
that's the party.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And so the whole idea is just to have a going away that's good and fun and right and celebrate your life well lived.
That is a big transition from where this country has been. It's always been seen as morbid. And sad and unhappy and miserable.
Terrible. Yeah. And just so the worst thing that could possibly happen, which is true, but it's natural. It's part of living is dying. So we need to prepare accordingly. And Christine, I've been well received talking about this all over the country. People are really beginning to understand that they can save their loved ones so much pain and suffering by just getting stuff figured out, written down, socked away, know where it is, passwords, whatever. And the obituary is kind of the easy way to get into it.
You can find a lot of information about all of this in Andy's book, Read This When I'm Dead, A Guide to Getting Your Stuff Together for Your Loved Ones. And I'm wondering how our listeners feel about having to write their own obituaries. Are you ready to do it? And what would you emphasize in yours? Our phone number, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, on your website, Andy, you list 5 reasons that people should get started now on this assignment. Let's walk through some of those. The first one, you can tell your own story in your own words, and you know stuff about yourself that no one else does.
Right. So when I was 12, I won a yo-yo contest. And when I tell my friends that, they laugh hysterically, and then the yo-yos all come out. I mean, why wouldn't that be a fun fact in my obituary?
Yeah. What else do you have in your obituary that's fun?
Well, of course, I've had a wonderfully exciting career as a fundraiser in politics and nonprofits, met a whole bunch of really awesome people.
And for people who don't know you well, you worked at the highest levels of the presidential campaigns. You raised money for George W. Bush's first campaign for the presidency, right?
Right. Well, and I'd known him since he was governor, but I met so many amazing people. And I'll never forget Margaret Thatcher climbing off a plane out here to come and do an event. And she said, "Oh, it's so nice to meet you." And her hair was flying off in the wind. And it was just, you know, just one thing after another I got to do as a result of my career. And unless you see all my pictures, you just don't know that. So I'll probably put a few stories in my obituary.
If people don't remember well, the money from that first George W. Bush campaign just came flying over the transom, right? That wasn't a heavy lift, Annie. He was so popular at the time. Yeah,
he was awesome. But you know, the thing that about George W. was that people liked him. They
people
really
liked him.
Gravitated
they
toward him.
They wanted to have a beer with him. That's why he won the presidency, people said.
And I'd worked for a lot of other people who'd run for president. But this guy, they really liked him. They'd hand him in their babies and ask for a photo, and they ask him to sign their names on their arms. And it was weird.
Come on, folks, give us a call out there. How do you feel about writing your own obit, and what would you emphasize in it? 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Number two on reasons for getting started now on writing your own obit, Annie, figuring out who and what matters to you is invigorating. Explain that to us.
Well, you've got to understand what's in your heart, and everybody knows what's in their heart, and oftentimes that isn't clear to others. And so if you're relying on others to tell about it, then you're going to get what they thought instead of what you thought. So on my heart, for example, are certain ideas about housing for single, hardworking moms and projects that I've tackled that a lot of people don't know about. And that would probably be part of my obituary, that I had made an effort to help.
And what's invigorating about all this, you point out?
Well, it makes me feel good.
Yeah.
It makes me feel like my life was worth it, that I did do something, that I was a contributor. And I think that's what we all want. We all want to be recognized for what we have accomplished.
Your number three reason here is it saves your family from having to write it, and they're going to be happy that someone else had taken care of it for them.
That's probably one of the greatest gifts that you can give your family, is just to have all your documents organized, all your information organized, and certainly write your obituary so they don't have to.
Number four, recalling favorite memories is a boost for your soul. Tell us about that.
Boost for your soul. Yeah. There's really nothing better than just understanding what you were all about for a life and give guidance to others, whether you've been a mentor or whether you want to be a shining, guiding light. Your soul is really what guides you. And so being that for yourself and for others is very, very meaningful.
We're talking about writing your own obituary. It's not as dismal a process as you might think it is. Annie Presley's my guest. Let's go to some phone calls here. And Michael from Armor Hills. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. I was hired, actually, a former freelance writer myself. I was hired by Sid Willens, who you may know, an attorney in town, who passed away. And he wanted to get his stuff together again, as your people are saying, to have the last word, but to, you know, put what he wanted to put into it. And my contribution, Sid did a lot of work in the paper, did a lot of book reviews. So the opening line was, Sid Willens always loved to see his name in the paper. Today, not so much. So that was the whole, and he took it from there. But I worked with him for several months before he passed, and it was a good experience for, I think, all concerned.
Well, why do you think he hired you, Michael? Why did he want this done ahead of time like this?
I think he just had a lot of things. He had kept papers of everything from going back into the from his Boy Scout years, through his legal career, through his Army days. He had been a writer himself. He had wanted to be a writer, and I think that was part of it. But again, I think he was the things that stuck out in his mind were the things that he wanted to be remembered for.
Michael, I'm glad you called. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's go to Kim from Kansas City, Missouri. Kim, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about writing your own obituary. Our phone number, 816-235-2888. Kim, you're on the air.
Hey, Annie. It's Kim Riley. How are you?
Hi, Kim. Doing well. Thanks.
Good. I just wanted to echo everything that you said. My grandmother, when she passed, I'm the writer of the family, so I was kind of given the task to lead us in writing her obituary, and we did what we could, you know, and then we, thank goodness, a family friend was a funeral director who pointed out that we had left out her church work, and that was so central to everything that she was, and so we were able to go back and edit the obituary and really flesh it out, and it was like, if it was someone else, I wouldn't have been so emotional and I would have easily included that in. But because it was so personal, my head just wasn't in the right place.
Oh,
so I just think it's time we shift
and
not think of it as morbid or don't think of yourself as vain for writing your own obituary.
Yeah. Kim, I'm glad you called. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
You know, Andy, is it hard, you know, to be truthful, and can you embellish your obit? I mean, people might be tempted to go down that road, you know.
Well, we see that on resumes all the time, so I suspect it would be in an obituary as well.
And no one's going to correct it.
Well, no, that's true. But I think also that oftentimes a person who really is ready to do this understands where they are in life and what they've been about and where they're headed. And so it's likely it'll be pretty accurate.
Is anything off limits when it comes to writing a self-obituary?
Well, honestly, I thought kind of the shouting out to people you don't like might not be in there, but I've seen some that actually list names of people they don't invite to the funeral.
So people are evening scores even at the end.
Yep. That happens. And little
what do you think
black
about
book,
that?
Little black book information is being revealed as well. So, wow. Very curious. It's a sign of the time, Steve. I mean, we're seeing all this polarization and anger and fear and all this just issues people have now. And so it's not surprising that it's going to start coming out.
You know, the other thing that strikes me about where we are in society right now is just how open people are. Some of the old barriers, things you could never talk about, seem to be fading away. I'm thinking about everything from, you know, mental health to personal life dramas. And, people are recognizing that all kinds of people have had the same struggles.
Sure. And we're seeing it on Facebook and pictures on Instagram and letters that go viral and just all kinds of information that once were topics that were completely off limits. So This is what's happening in this industry as well. And we embrace it. We think it's time for people to really think through where their stuff is and where it needs to go and what they're going to do with it and how to characterize their lives.
Do you ever hold workshops on the whole idea of writing your own obituary? Is that something you guys have done?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And we're actually accepting invitations for next year now. This year's closed, but next year's open to come and just go through the paperwork. I've just got a small workshop, a small little presentation, and then you actually sit down with others and write it all out and just give it a start.
It's just so amazing to me because you're right. This is such a shift. I mean, this is that we're having this conversation for one thing and talking about what we're talking about. It's amazing.
It's a huge shift. And in a way, if you look back, for example, my husband's grandparents all died in the home. So he was familiar with this whole process.
Mm-hmm.
And then that shifted and people started dying in hospitals and then were moved to hospice. And now it's turning back. People are starting to head back home now and care for their loved ones. So it's kind of come full circle.
Let's go to Leanne from Kansas City, Missouri. Leanne, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. I really am enjoying this show.
Oh, good. Thanks.
I wanted to mention my dear mother, who passed away last year at the age of 84. My mother was a wonderful writer herself. And she wrote her obituary well in advance, and it really emphasized all of the things that were truly important to her and that really, really made up her personality. And I had to update it a little bit, but other than a few updates, I did not touch a word of her obituary.
What did she emphasize, Leanne?
She emphasized her writing. She was a prolific poet. She also emphasized her love of music because she was an amateur musician all of her life. And she also, one of the things she said was that she was a compulsive crossword puzzle worker, and she did the New York Times crossword puzzle, I think, every day of her life.
Oh, that's a badge of honor.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, so those were the things that she mentioned about herself and the things she wanted to be remembered for.
Oh, that's great, Leanne. Thank you for calling. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
As we're sitting here, Annie, talking to all these good folks, I'm just thinking there might be something, you know, healthy about a self-assessment at the end of one's life that sort of makes, you know, makes some sense to me as we're talking about this.
A lot of times families are ready and to hear from the loved one who is passing, and it gives that opportunity for the loved one to think through what they did in their lives for their people. And hopefully it's opening up those pathways so that there can be some healing and some serious love that occurs before the person does die. But, you know, everybody's going to die. We say this, and it's not a secret. It's just hard.
Yeah.
And this makes it a lot easier. One thing we did forget to say, though, Steve.
Yeah.
One of the best parts about writing your own obituary is you can choose your own photo.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
And find it and make it available so that it's not your, you know, goofy one.
Goofy one, right.
Right.
Well, that's Annie Pressley, co-author of Read This When I'm Dead, A Guide to Getting Your Stuff Together for Your Loved Ones. Annie, it's always great to have you here. Thanks for filling us in one more time.
I appreciate it. Swing by your Hallmark store and pick one up.
Pick one up. There you go. If you missed a previous episode of the program or you want to listen again or stream it, just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. And here's a tip. Listen back to my conversation last week about how climate change is already affecting Kansas prairies. Tomorrow we meet a couple of freshman lawmakers and ask them what it's like making the transition from candidate to state representative. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Emily Reed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.